Well, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Thanks for coming, Angie.
I'm sorry I didn't make it last week. But you wouldn't have wanted me to be here last week, so just as well.
Yeah. Well,
I still have it. It's still in my chest.
Oh dear.
Yeah. It always goes there.
You feel okay though?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay.
Yeah. But I thought what I would do is just share with you. This is a wonderful chapter because it's called The Four Noble Truths That Are Not. Because it's canceled out in the Heart Sutra. No suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path. And then he goes on, no cognition, no attainment, no, et cetera, et cetera. And so in the end, he talks about sort of Buddha's teaching, his basic teaching. That he spent 45 years teaching, first the Four Noble Truths, and he said only afterwards, as these are hard to understand, did he explain the interdependent causes. And then he taught the six paramitas. He spoke to the common people, and they clustered around him and listened attentively. He used words meaningful to them and thus enabled them to become awakened. When he spoke to learned people or to the sophists of his era, he used their logic and showed in an irrefutable way the truth of the law of the 12 interdependent causes. Finally, he taught the bodhisattvas, who already had some understanding of the Dharma and a certain level of awakening. He instructed them to practice the six paramitas, and it said he spent 15 years teaching the he's using Japanese words suddenly. Teaching the common people. And then the disciples who sat in profound silence. A gathering of disciples sat in profound silence. The teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the 12 Enin, and the six paramitas worked within each person from within, immediately, without the detours of language, but by directly immersing the consciousness in universal truth, in emptiness. Thus, true wisdom manifests itself during Zazen without effort, without searching, without a desire to understand or obtain anything. Unconsciously, naturally, and automatically, it is realized through Mushotoku, mind, the mind without any desire for gain or reward. This is Satori, which continues beyond the walls of the days, beyond the posture of the dojo, beyond the posture of Zazen. So after all these analyses of the words of the Heart Sutra, each chapter comes down to the same thing, that Mushotoku mind, the mind of no gaining, of no attaining, no getting anywhere, is the crux of what we're doing. And it's not easy to do. It's not easy to drop our attachment to ourself and our wish to be more or better or to do it the right way. There isn't any right way. And to be just, to be relaxed, as he said, I think is what Will Johnson says in his book, and that I think that's really crucial, to be relaxed as we sit. It's hard to be upright. It's getting harder and harder for me because my back is so skewed now. But it still makes a difference. You know, if your head is back, then the shoulders drop down and the elbows can be out the way they, you feel like the air is all around you. It's much more comfortable. So Koban always said, just pay attention to your posture. Don't worry about anything else. And don't think your posture is because you're trying to be a good person or anything. It just makes sitting easier. So that's all, I think, that we really need. Although it's very interesting, all the things that he has to say about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path especially, which is my favorite. I just think it's so cool that after all the different kinds of spiritual practices and religions that have been invented in the world, that in Buddhism it all boils down to just taking care of yourself and everybody, and getting a good job that doesn't hurt anybody, and that's it. Have a practice. It's not special. It's just very particular, very ordinary. So I don't know, maybe you all have insight into this too. Wendy?
I watch the news in the afternoon before I come, and they were talking about the ceasefire in Yemen. So Yemen's been on my mind. And so if you were in a war situation, I think this practice of Zazen would be very unique, very special.
Oh, it would be impossible, really. And if you're starving, it's impossible. If you're homeless and sleeping on a sidewalk, it's probably not possible either. I think we're so fortunate because we have enough to eat and we have shelter and a safe place to be so that we can practice. And that's the difference. Once people feel safe enough, they can do it. Once they are safe enough, they can enter this realm. But that makes the difference.
So it really does. Does it offer a refuge if you're in danger? Because a lot of religions say they do.
Well, having never been in a war, I don't know, but I doubt it. Any more than just to trust what you don't know. I mean, our life really is a war. We don't know every moment what's going to happen to us.
Well, that is true. We're living in the unknown, and it is precarious, yes.
Yeah. It's like Leslie. She was feeling fine and very busy, and suddenly she had a bad backache. And boom! Life-threatening cancer. And those kinds of things happen all the time to people. And we don't let ourselves go there. If we're feeling fine, it's real hard to think about it, because we like to think we're going to last forever. I would. Let's just keep going. We're doing fine. But no, we're not going to. Yeah, I saw that too. And I saw the one about the woman with the eye patch who kept going back, a reporter, a journalist.
A private war? You went to see that?
No, this was a woman who was real.
A
journalist.
They just made a movie, a documentary on it, called A Private War.
I see. Well, I just saw a journalistic thing about her.
I see.
And how she just kept going back and going back into the war, and finally they knew where she was and they dropped a bomb on her. Just like that. So some people are more brave than others, but you're frowning.
No, I'm not really frowning. I'm thinking. I just wonder, you know, there's so many Japanese soldiers were Buddhists. Mm. And some were even Zen Buddhists.
Yes.
And yet they either felt it was their duty to fight in the war, or maybe they didn't really have a choice. No.
Yeah.
So I just did it. I wonder. I haven't read much stories about it. How their practice could have affected their consciousness in a terrible war.
Well, Katagiri Roshi was a pilot, a kamikaze pilot.
Oh, really?
He was training to be in the plane that couldn't come back, that would just crash into something and he would die with it.
But he didn't actually do it.
The war ended just before he graduated.
Oh.
So, but he never talked about Zazen in terms of it. I think he just had to do it because he was a young man.
Yeah. Well, there are some... The Japanese military got sent a lot of the kamikaze pilots to Zen monasteries to try to train them to be, you know,
samurai,
you know, in the role of the kamikaze. And there is one teacher, I can't remember, who refused to do it.
Mm?
Refused to.
I don't know who that was.
Yeah, well, I read about it. And then he was punished, of course. I don't know if the church punished him, but the government did somehow. Or put him in jail or something. But it, you know, it seemed like that's a curious thing.
Well, they had a samurai notion, that Zen was to prepare you to die and to prepare you to pull the sword and run through whoever is in front of you. So it still is in a lot of ways. I think at Aheiji it looked like they were training young men in order to be able to do what, overcome themselves. And Coben came out of that saying, what did he say? I can't remember, but he said it was really, really bad. Really, really bad. they push the ego out of him. It's something like that. They just squeezed the ego out, so there was nothing left.
It was so intertwined with their culture, you know.
Yes.
I mean, the samurai ideal and the Zen mm-hmm. principles, sort of a kind of stoicism.
Yeah. Well, that's parts breaking down. It's certainly broken down in America. It's interesting to see. Though I don't know, it's still kind of like that. If you go to very strict Zen centers, it's, you know, enter the Zendo with the left foot. If you don't do that, they scream at you. You know, if you don't bow to your cushion, they scream at you. They make you do everything and humiliate you so that your ego is damaged and you have to learn how not to care if you do something wrong. And of course, it's set up to make you try to do everything right because it's so quiet and everybody else is so perfect. So it's a great situation for undoing you.
It's also a great situation for people. It can be a great situation for people who are interested in being the ones in charge of an entire group of newbies or
wannabes,
and inspirational, sincere, spiritual seekers to just get them to. So what kind of person aspires to become a professional spiritual taskmaster?
I can't imagine wanting that. That isn't the point, and that was not what Buddha was doing.
Right, but it sometimes seems, what I hear about other places, particularly straight Zen center or whatever, it seems as though it's set up as a disciplinary machine rather than a spiritual practice.
Yes.
Opportunity or even a machine. I mean, I'm machine has a kind of negative connotation. I can see a good machine, but it always seems to be set up to process people.
Well, it's on purpose so that this institution, which means the structure, this was a big subject for me when I was at Chikoji, the structure requires a lot of support. And the way you get support is to get students. And then you have to discipline them and give them jobs and make sure they get them done. And so it's all set up for that. That keeps the institution going. So how do you offer the Dharma in an institution? Because every institution is set up to create a situation where the Dharma can be available for people, where people can sit and discover in their own mind and body, in their own heart and belly, what this is. And it's so it doesn't add up. But that's how it works. In order to have the institution, you have to have a cook and a bottle washer and you know, everybody to take care of everything. So you give them names and you give them things like this and positions, and it becomes a hierarchy, and some people are more important than others. And of course they take it on and sort of strut around with their importance and flap their robes and
did you say schlep or flap?
The flap.
Flap, okay.
It's human nature. it's how we do things. And I think it doesn't work very well as far as the Dharma is concerned. It just doesn't. It just makes a mess.
It seems to create an opportunity for I can't finish that sentence.
Yes.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned hierarchy, and as you must know, in the Jacobi bylaws, one of the first things it states is that we don't operate with hierarchy. There is no hierarchy. It specifies things like the people involved. I think it probably specifies the board of directors, the leaders, that they don't work for, oh, I can't remember it, but they work to serve the institution but not govern it. It's a slight contradiction, or mm-hmm. not contradiction, but it's a little bit of a paradox in how it's described. There's a big emphasis on no hierarchy.
Yes.
Yet it can't operate without somebody saying, well, even gently saying, well, why don't we do this? No, really, why don't we do this? Really, we should do it this way. So what's the rationale behind the no hierarchy idea when it can't really operate that way? Is it just another Zen paradox?
Well, usually, yeah, of course. Of course, it's always a paradox. But in the way it is usually run is that the abbot appoints all the various officers, and then the officers take care of various responsibilities, and those change over and over, so nobody keeps a position for a long time, much less forever, including the abbot. The abbots are there for a long time, but they leave too. Nobody stays at the Zen temple and runs the place. They all come and go. So, and part of training is learning how to do those things, and some people are good at them and stay for longer, and some leave right away and go back home after they're done with their training. So it just depends, but in every case, it's a fluid situation. It's not fixed. Mm-hmm. So what Koban, when he offered one of these of every, whatever kind, whatever color, he always said, it's a stepping down. Please understand that this is a stepping down. This is taking on more responsibility for the Dharma. It doesn't mean that you have anything to do with the situation itself unless you want it to be. But you're not being given a place in the Sangha that's better than anybody else.
But surely an abbot or a head teacher, simply by having those titles is structurally superior.
But if they're not good at their work, then they're a failure.
But who would be in a position to say,
well,
that you're not good at your work?
Well,
and not get, shown.
Yes, well, in Zen, there's the Soto Shu, which is the headquarters that sort of keeps an eye on all the various temples and makes sure that everybody is doing it right. And Koban always said we shouldn't join them either, so it's but yeah, it does take some organization and somebody willing to take the responsibility, which is what the abbot does. And the abbot appoints a director, and then the director is in charge because that's how it works. But then they don't keep those jobs.
The abbot that appoints a director. I was under the impression, I could be wrong, that Jacuji, the head teacher currently, the guiding teacher currently, Magnolia, is also the director. Is that right?
Well, I don't know. In Haiku Zendo, Koben was the abbot, and he told us who was going to do what. And that changed a lot. That changed at least twice a year. And there was always a director who was in charge of making sure people did what they were assigned to do. And then that shifted and changed into another pattern. But Koben had the final say. So being the director and the teacher is a big mistake, and that was my mistake. That's what I was doing. And it was horrible. I mean, it's really awful. You can't do it.
And is it because as the teacher, you're dealing with spiritual functions, and as a director, you're an administrator? And
yes.
You're just keeping those separate?
Yes.
Right.
And you don't have time for both of them. They're both big jobs. And they both take a certain kind of mind, and they're different. They're very different.
The relationship you would have with the full sangha, but certainly with an on-site sangha, this residential, with the Ajikoji, would have to be very different, because the operational needs are, no, this has to be done now, this has to be done now. Whereas spiritually, it's wherever you are, in your practice, and understanding, and it's got nothing to do with getting the meals done, or getting, or keeping the zendo swept, or, yeah.
Yeah. I don't think humanity has figured out very well how to do this human job. I think we're trying and trying to make it work with each other, and to understand each other and understand what this is all about. And nobody does. Nobody knows what really how we came to be alive in the world, much less how we need to take care of each other and take care of the situation, including the earth. We're really bumbling around in a huge amount of ignorance at this point. And there's so many of us, we just keep making more and more of ourselves. So, and the more crowded it is, the more confused we get. The Bay Area is a great example of that. The traffic is terrible. Ron knows very well.
too bad. I mean, I'm lucky. I don't have a lot of condo. Well, to me, it's just the energy of the place, not just the traffic.
Yes.
It kind of goes with the high-tech culture. You know, the emphasis on succeeding as much as possible, as quickly as possible, so, you know,
yes.
A lot of pressure on anybody who has a job. That's pretty relentless.
It is.
That combined with the traffic and, you know, so that's it. So it does create quite a bit of stress, which we see every day.
Yeah.
Sort of goes with the territory. And I don't know the answer. I don't see whether it's going to change kind of the system.
No. Nobody knows. Everybody's there are many people trying to think it through.
But, you know, I've been here long enough. I've seen it change, you know. I mean, there's always been job pressure, but
It's exponential.
It's really, really escalating. You know, I see so many people that are just totally stressed, totally frustrated, you know, kind of on the verge of being burned out a lot of the time, you know.
Of course, yeah.
Just the whole situation, you know, it's always nice to go away. Actually, I was in Europe, yeah. And that was nice. But I didn't get that, you know, in the cities there, I didn't really... You know, just a regular city.
Yeah, you can
have that perception of everybody being, you know, kind of crazy right here.
Yeah.
But I just notice it here. You know, so, yeah.
My father-in-law used to draw a line of population. And it's just going up from almost straight, going up just a little bit, and then all of a sudden goes straight up. He says, now what are we going to do? And it seems like maybe that's where we are now.
However, the Dharma can be a great useless for dealing with that too.
Yes. Yes, that's why we're here. Yeah. Well, it's 8 o'clock, believe it or not.
Believe it or not.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll do our 1 minute sit.
Yeah, well, announcements.
Announcements?